Active History is pleased to present a recording of Brad Miller's talk, British North America and International Law in the 1860s. The talk was delivered on April 22, 2017, as part of the Other 60s, a decade that shaped Canada and the world, a symposium hosted by the Department of History at the University of Toronto.
I'm going to talk about a particular branch of international law where the 1860s was formative in British North America and post-Confederation Canada, and that's the extradition of fugitive criminals. Simply put, in the 1860s, Canadian courts began the process of creating a body of jurisprudence, that is, a body of extradition case law, almost from nothing. As they did so, they implanted in this new body of law interpretive values and methodologies that have guided it ever since. These interpretive values were what I'm going to call liberalizing. That is, they sought to erode domestic barriers to international cooperation against crime. They prioritized what the jurists, anyways, saw as doing justice between civilized governments. And as part of that sense of justice between governments, they were indifferent to individual rights concerns and actively hostile to legal technicalities. Liberalizing judges saw themselves really as modernizers. They saw themselves as creating a body of law that could best deal with a world and in particular, a northern North American world, where human migration was easy and common. They saw themselves as crafting something that could deal, in fact, with a world in which people could move between jurisdictions and across borders with much, much more dexterity than law. So I'm going to explain all this by reference to a particularly formative case from the 1860s. And the case that I'm going to talk about is that of Bennett G. Burleigh, which was decided in 1865 here in Toronto. This is sometimes called the Lake Erie Pirates case, though I think the word pirate radically overstates the preparation and professionalism of Burleigh and his friends. We'll get to that in a second. Burleigh was a Scot in his early 20s. He joined the armed forces of the Southern Confederacy in the U.S. Civil War. And in 1865, he was part of a comically inept plan to seize a U.S. warship on Lake Erie and then to rescue thousands of Southern POWs from a prison fortress on a nearby island. The plan fizzled. And essentially, all that the group did was to seize two small private ships on the lake, to steal some clothes from one of the crew members, and to steal $20 from one of the ship owners. That's that's the issue with the preparation and professionalism. Burleigh got arrested in Upper Canada when the Americans decided to request his extradition on the charge of having stolen the $20. And from the moment that he gets arrested, the Burleigh case is a huge deal. The oral arguments in two levels of court were reprinted verbatim in the press. Newspapers and policymakers across British North America, the United States, and the United Kingdom followed the story and followed the details of the case very closely. When they get into court, Burleigh's lawyers make a bunch of technical legal arguments first. So they start with quite technical legal arguments about things like the warrant that the magistrate used in committing Burleigh for extradition. They then argue that as a British subject, as a Scot, as a British subject, Burleigh can't be surrendered to a foreign state, that the government simply doesn't have that power over him. And then they argue, in what was certainly the most politically provocative aspect of the case, they then argue that Burleigh couldn't be treated as a criminal. He's not individually liable to the criminal law. because he was part of a lawful act of war staged by and sanctioned by a state that had recognized belligerent rights in international law. In other words, he simply isn't liable to the criminal law, and therefore he can't be extradited as a criminal. Now, here's where we get back to the issue of legal liberalization. We get back to it because after the magistrate commits Burley, four Upper Canada Superior Court justices sit on the case. All four squarely rejected the idea that he was immune from domestic criminal law as a belligerent. All four dispense with this idea. In fact, I want to kind of flag this decision for people who are interested in the history of international law because it's a really rich case. It's a really rich decision for people interested in the laws of war. But I think it's actually on the more ordinary issues of legal technicality. It's much more important on the issues of things like the citizenship rights of Burley or the legal technicalities that have to be communicated in a committing warrant by a magistrate. It's on these issues where the Burley case was most important and most impactful. And it's here, it's on those issues that the courts began this process of developing a liberalizing jurisprudence. Now, the judges rule against the defense on every single issue. And I think there's two key underlying themes. There's two key underlying liberalizing themes in the Burley rulings. The first is an open trust of American justice. That is, a very powerful belief in American legal fairness. In fact, that's part of why they rule against Burley on the issue of him being a soldier, on him having belligerent rights, because they say that that's a defense and that as such, it's an issue for an American jury and that America is a trustworthy jurisdiction. They have to, and in fact, they say explicitly they want to assume that the case will be dealt with and that Burley will be dealt with fairly. The sentiment underlying that is the idea that Canada and the U.S. are fundamentally similar polities. That in the words of one of the judges in the Burley case, the two countries had, as he put it, a common language and laws and institutions. As a result of that, in this view, it was both desirable and safe to surrender even British subjects to be dealt with by American law. We'll come back to this idea in a minute. The second interpretive value is the idea that the law had to respond to the interconnectedness of societies in northern North America. The justices were keenly aware, as they deliberated on the case, they were keenly aware that if they sided with the defense on the technical questions or the citizenship question, if they did that, they might fundamentally erode the power of law in both countries. The best example of this, certainly not the only example, but I think the best example of this is how they dealt with the citizenship question. That is, how they dealt with the idea that Burley couldn't be surrendered to the U.S. because he was a British subject. One of the judges reasoned through this in part by saying that many British subjects lived in the U.S. and many American citizens lived in Canada. He said the border between the two countries was, as he put it, an imaginary line. The result is that if the court shielded all Canadians who committed a crime in the U.S. just as long as they could get across that imaginary line, if they did that, the courts would be, in his words, affording impunity to crime. So that broader perspective, that kind of shared continental or transnational interest in the rule of law, that shaped how the justices interpreted questions like which persons were eligible for extradition under the Anglo-American Treaty. So I think those are the two pervasive liberalizing themes in Burley. All of this kind of broad interpretive message of the Burley case was summarized by Justice John Hawkins Hagerty. At the end of his short opinion, Hagerty included a statement that summarized, as he saw it, the task of an extradition judge. So in his view, in Hawkins's view, judges should interpret extradition treaties and statutes in what he called, and these are his words, a liberal and just spirit, not laboring with eager astuteness to find flaws or doubtful meanings in its words. There's a few important things in that statement. There's a few important approaches embedded in this. The first is the thing about being liberal, by which he meant being broad and purposive in interpreting and applying the law. Then there's the idea of the just spirit, by which he meant, as I mentioned up front, doing justice between governments. Justice between governments and individuals was marginal at best in Justice Hagerty's extradition writings. And then there's the eager astuteness comment. The eager astuteness comment, I think, got across his hostility, his enduring hostility, I should say, to the idea that justice between nations could be frustrated by technicalities of law, especially technicalities of domestic law. In his view, extradition was bigger than that. Now, that little statement tucked into the end of Hagerty's opinion became an emblem and an interpretive guide for generations of Canadian courts that followed him. In the 50 years of case law after Burley that I looked at, that statement is quoted and cited and paraphrased and echoed and reiterated, perhaps in hand-me-down form, by dozens of courts. And in doing that, in appearing like that, it carried real interpretive weight in this liberalizing case law. So that statement and the Burley case generally became the founding precedent of Canadian extradition law. Oh, thanks. Now, I want to talk for a second about how, as historians, we should explain what happened in the Burley case. And I think there are three key contexts that that help us understand the case. The first is American power, especially in the Civil War period. As Steve Penfold explained earlier in explaining his hashtag, this was a period of remarkable tension and much fear on the Canadian side about an American invasion. In that tension, in that fear, extradition actually played a kind of weirdly huge role in creating and exacerbating that tension of fear. At the same time that the Burley case was playing out, in Toronto, courts in Montreal were hearing the St. Albans Raiders case. This was also an extradition case that this one stemmed from an attack that a group of Confederates staged on St. Albans, Vermont. The Superior Court ultimately decided not to extradite the Raiders. So the court decided that they were lawful combatants, exempt from domestic criminal law. That decision infuriated many Americans and terrified many Canadians. In New Brunswick, meanwhile, a court had already, as of the time that Burley was heard, already decided not to extradite a group of Confederate pirates that had seized an American ship and fled into the Maritimes. As a result, thinking about this context of American power and tensions along the Canadian-American border, as a result, some legal scholars who've critiqued the Burley case say that it was simply decided on the basis of diplomatic necessity, and that it was doctrinally incorrect. Now, I always get nervous about attributing this or that court decision, this or that kind of jurisprudential outcome, to moments of political necessity. I'm nervous about the idea that the law is simply the sum total of the immediate circumstances in which the case happened. I get nervous about that because it usually, I think, understates meaningful and historically significant longer-term dynamics that shape how law operates. And that kind of gets me to the second and third factors that should help us understand the Burley case and the principles that it represents. The second context is the profound and everyday frustration before, I should say long before, and long after the Civil War, the profound frustration with the limits of the formal law. Here's the key thing about that. In this period, the Anglo-American extradition treaty covered only seven crimes. That meant that for all the other offenses, the border delineated a formal refuge from the reach of the criminal law. So if you committed assault or rape or fraud or theft, if you committed burglary or you embezzled, you needed to only get over that imaginary line that the Burley judge noted to be formally immune from the force of the law. And in fact, just as Burley was being decided, an embezzler in Upper Canada stole $10,000 from his employer and made it across into New York State. One of the Hamilton newspapers editorialized on the case, saying this rightly about the criminal. This is the word from the editorial. These are the words from the editorial. He, the embezzler, may live within sight of Canada and laugh at the officers across the border without fear of being arrested. Now, that same frustration, that same sense of legal powerlessness bubbled up in an array of 1860s extradition decisions. Before and after the Burley case, judges expressed open dissatisfaction with those limits. Haggerty himself, Justice Haggerty, said in 1868 that what he called the present law was, as he put it, unfortunately powerless over the most common crimes that were committed in northern North America. Justice John Wilson, who was also on the bench in Burley, said that same year that he hoped for what he called a more liberal treaty. Now, the final factor, the third factor I think that helps us understand Burley is the powerful idea of a shared and common North American civilization. Now, we sometimes think of Canadian jurists in this period as being really snitty about American law, right? We sometimes imagine them as thinking that the Americans had lynch law while we had British justice. That is, in certain places and times, true, I think, but it was not the view. That was not the view of these extradition judges who, to be clear, were the ones most responsible for connecting these two legal systems, these two British and American legal systems in practice. Long before and long after Burley, jurists posited a profound and enduring common civilization, key dimensions of which, essential dimensions of which, were about law. I think I mentioned before those comments in Burley about trusting American courts and about the two countries having a purportedly common law language and set of institutions. Now, that sense of shared civilization had substantive meaning as a legal value. So, for example, from the 1810s to the 1840s, colonial policymakers and judges had actually tried to build an extradition system with some of the northern states outside of any formal Anglo-American treaty, partly on the basis of that idea of a shared civilization and the idea that civilized states had legal obligations to one another. Now, for a bunch of reasons, that attempt at a system fell apart, but the values underpinning it didn't vanish. So what happens after an extradition treaty is implemented is that judges bring those values to bear on interpreting the treaty terms and the provisions of the statutes that implemented it. In other words, the idea of trusting that Burley would get a fair trial wasn't kind of pulled from the ether because of American pressure during the Civil War. So I guess my point about this is twofold. First, that the Burley decision reflected Canadian views and not just American power. This is an area of scholarship in which historians sometimes rush in to frame the issue as American imperialism or American expansionism, and that, in my view, begs the question. It assumes the answer. Second, that the focus in Burley on eroding technicalities in really important ways reflected the sense among judges that they had to work as intentionally as possible to sustain a very flawed system. Now, what Burley and then a series of other cases also in the 1860s did was to crystallize those values in precedent, to lay them out in general terms like Haggerty did at the end of his opinion, but also to bring them to bear on technical legal questions at a time in which there was almost no reported case law. So as judges turned by necessity to Burley to find out what the requirements of an extradition warrant were, for example, they also absorbed and then reapplied the interpretive framework that it espoused. And so I want to leave with a final point, and that's that as federal Canada emerged and as jurisdictional and geopolitical boundaries became an obsession domestically, I was thinking about Steve's comment earlier about us all walking around with the word jurisdiction snapped on our heads as good Canadians. As that was happening, jurists were already thinking hard about how best that Canada's borders could coexist with types of law that reached across them. Thanks.
You've been listening to Brad Miller's talk, British North America and International Law in the 1860s. The talk was delivered on April 22, 2017, as part of The Other 60s, a decade that shaped Canada and the world, a symposium hosted by the Department of History at the University of Toronto. You can find recordings of other talks at activehistory.ca, and be sure to subscribe to the History Chats podcast feed, wherever you get your podcasts.